From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Senate will take up President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 aid package this week after passing the House on Saturday. And Republicans continue to oppose the bill at a time when leaders are taking a hard look at the future of the party.
Over the weekend, one vision of the GOP's future was on display at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Former President Donald Trump delivered his first speech since leaving office. He criticized the new Biden administration on immigration, among other things. He also repeated false conspiracy theories about election fraud and called out Republican lawmakers who voted to impeach him. Whit Ayers is a longtime Republican pollster and president of North Star Opinion Research. He's in Washington. Whit, what stood out to you at CPAC?
Well, CPAC has always been drawn from the right part of the GOP's center-right coalition, but this year it really went off the deep end. The agenda was completely scrubbed of anything except total fealty to Donald Trump. Fully seven panels, as you mentioned, were devoted to the myth that Joe Biden stole the election. So it was a real far-right convention this year especially.
I want to ask you about a couple numbers that stand out in a straw poll. So Trump said he wouldn't start a third party, but he did leave the window open to running again in 2024. And so a straw poll found that 95% of people at the conference do want the GOP to keep advancing Trump policies, but only 68% of people said they actually want him to run again in 2024. So does that surprise you? And do you think his supporters actually want to see somebody else carry the torch?
Yeah, that surprises me. You would expect that to be closer to 90% given the favorable opinion of Donald Trump, which does suggest that they're at least open to some other alternative. Although it's worth pointing out that the CPAC straw polls are not exactly the best predictors of what's likely to happen in the GOP. Of the previous eight straw polls, five times a winner was Rand Paul or his father Ron Paul.
I'm sure you're disappointing Ron DeSantis and Kristi Noem then, who also fared well in the straw polls, but well, take them for what they're worth. I do want to ask you a little bit more about the substance of the former president's speech. You know, he criticized President Biden on fracking, the pandemic, school closures, among other things. He also talked about the meaning of this term, Trumpism. Here he is.
It means low taxes and eliminating job-killing regulations, Trumpism. It means strong borders, but people coming into our country based on a system of merit.
Now, Whit, Trump also said the mission of the party has to be to create good jobs, strong families, safe communities. I mean, do you see things in that future vision for the party that would appeal to more than just his existing Trump supporters, that would actually expand the GOP base?
Well, certainly the more traditional GOP emphasis on jobs, opportunity, good education, strong international presence for the United States. Clearly, the more traditional GOP agenda has been very popular in the past and I think could be potentially popular in the future. But that's not what people generally remember Donald Trump for.
You know, Whit, in the past, you've called on Republicans to work harder to appeal to non-white voters. In the 2020 election, it was a surprise to many political observers that Trump actually increased his share of Latino voters relative to what he did in 2016. And despite a history of racist statements and emboldening white supremacists, he did win more than 10% of the votes from Black Americans. And according to NBC, that's the highest share for a Republican in 20 years. So how do you view that performance?
Right. There were some moves at the margins anyway in the right direction. Most of those gains came among non-white men, blue-collar men for the most part. So it steps in the right direction, but we're still a long way from where we need to be attractive in a very diversifying America.
You know, I want to ask you about one last thing with that the former president said in his speech, which is, we will do what we've done right from the beginning, which is to win. Now, I mean, both parties obviously focus a lot on trying to win. But as he thinks about maybe trying to be the first president to come back and win a second term after losing his reelection bid, since Grover Cleveland did it in 1892, I'm reminded of how that contrasts with what Grover Cleveland himself said, which is, what is the use of being elected or reelected unless you stand for something? So, I mean, do you see the GOP standing for something right now, or are they totally focused on winning?
Well, the GOP is in the midst of a major battle for the future of the party. We're split between the governing faction and a populist faction. That struggle will probably not be ended until the party nominates someone in 2024 who will redefine the party in his or her image.
You know, Whit, we've also seen a number of Republican legislatures at the state level introducing various bills that would arguably reduce voting rights, at least make voting less accessible than it was in 2020 with, you know, easy access to mail-in ballots. Do you see that becoming a major focus of the party going forward?
Well, clearly there are some reforms that are perfectly reasonable, like beginning to count mail-in ballots well before the actual election day. But any effort to try to deny legitimate voters from voting is going to backfire. The GOP's goal should be every eligible voter votes and no ineligible voters vote. That should be the North Star.
That's Whit Ayers. He's a Republican pollster and president of North Star Opinion Research. Whit, thanks for joining us.
Surely, Cal. Good to be with you.
Today, the Biden administration is expected to announce more ways it will hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, issued a declassified report on Friday and said Saudi Arabia's crown prince was responsible for the killing of Khashoggi, who was a U.S. resident. Haines has been in her position for over a month now, overseeing all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies. Greg Myrie, NPR's national security correspondent, joins us now with the latest. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
So, Greg, Haines sat down for an interview with you and NPR's Mary Louise Kelly on Friday. Just as this declassified report was released, what's been the impact of that report so far?
Well, you know, I really can't think of a precedent like this where the U.S. government is openly accusing a leader of an ally nation that he's responsible for a high-profile killing. So it's a clear message that the Biden administration is going to take a different approach towards Saudi Arabia, a U.S. ally for generations. Already in the first little over a month, Biden has canceled arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He's pressing the Saudis for a diplomatic solution to the war in Yemen, where they're deeply involved. Now, some critics say he should be doing even more than that, that he didn't specifically impose any sanctions on the crown prince. And that debate will carry on. Still, this is a very significant move.
Mm. The January 6th attack on the Capitol has sharpened this focus on domestic terrorism. And Mary Louise Kelly asked Haines about this threat. Let's listen.
Do you think domestic terrorism is now a greater threat than international?
I try to resist comparing them, to be honest, but I think there is no question that the domestic terrorism threat continues to be just increasing challenge for us. And certainly the racially and ethnically motivated violence that we're seeing is increasing. And we've seen that from the intelligence community over the last few years. I think quite some jarring reports that demonstrate that.
And so she's absolutely right. This will be challenging. Her office, the Office for the Director of National Intelligence, was set up after the 9/11 attacks to fight al-Qaeda. It's very outward-looking, and along with the CIA and the National Security Agency, they're scanning the globe for these foreign threats. It's really not geared for domestic extremism. And so she made the point that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security would be taking the lead in these domestic threats, and that her office can certainly assist, and that most threats these days do have a transnational component, both a foreign and a domestic element. But clearly, the writ large, the U.S. Security agencies are going to have to adapt if they intend to focus a little more on domestic threats.
Mm. Haines is leading the Office of National Intelligence following a volatile 4 years during the Trump administration. And she says she actually has a message she wants to send to the intelligence community. Let's listen.
I want you to know that I'm not going to be in any way retaliating against you if you don't tell me what I want to hear. And you have now a president who very much wants to hear what you have to say, regardless of whether or not it's consistent with his particular policy views or any of those things.
What did Haines say about how intelligence had been politicized under the previous administration and how Biden's approach will perhaps be different? You've kind of been speaking to this.
Right. I mean, we pressed her. She didn't give specific examples, but she said there was political pressure taking place. The former president openly criticized intelligence officials when they didn't agree on his preferred narrative on events about Russia in particular. We saw these public contradictions where officials could get fired. And the Biden administration is trying to make the point right now that, in fact, they welcome points of view that may not agree with President Biden's view on things. There should be this open discussions. So that's something she's going to emphasize, and we'll just have to see if that's what indeed happens.
Yes, a lot to follow here. Avril Haines sat down for an interview with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly and Greg Myrie on Friday, and you can hear that full conversation on All Things Considered. Greg, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The AstraZeneca Oxford coronavirus vaccine is ready for distribution in Africa. A flight carrying 600,000 doses arrived last week in Accra, and the vaccines will now be used throughout Ghana. NPR's Eder Peralta joins us. Eder, this is a long-awaited step for the African continent because a plan to roll out the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine in South Africa, where you are, was put on hold early last month. So remind us what happened, and how did a plan to make use of this vaccine in Africa get back on track?
Yeah, so it was a pretty heartbreaking moment here in South Africa. It's been the most affected country on the continent with tens of thousands of deaths. And scientists in South Africa revealed that one of their studies had found that the AstraZeneca vaccine was not very effective. So they stopped the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine and came to an agreement with Johnson & Johnson that they would bring in some doses of that to try and vaccinate their health workers. About 67,000 healthcare workers have been vaccinated, but obviously it's not the 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine that they've basically have no use for now.
AstraZeneca vaccine is now going into Ghana, and Ghana getting this shipment, Eder, is getting it through the WHO's global vaccine sharing COVAX program. So for people who aren't familiar with that, can you explain how the COVAX initiative works?
The COVAX authority is basically, it's a facility backed by the WHO in which richer countries buy vaccines, and then poorer countries are given vaccines for free. That said, poorer countries are not getting nearly enough vaccines that they need.
What do we know, Eder, about how Ghana plans to vaccinate people in that case? As you say, it's not nearly enough to achieve herd immunity in that country. So what are the priority groups, at least with this first batch?
As you might know, here on the continent, there are very few doctors and nurses per capita. And that's why they're starting with healthcare workers.
For context, Ghana has already recorded more than 84,000 coronavirus cases and about 600 deaths. And like other countries, Eder, it's facing rumors and skepticism about vaccines. So how is it confronting that? And what are some of the safety concerns that people have about the vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, look, the WHO Africa has been trying to tell Africans as a whole, right, that this vaccine has gone through regulatory authorities and that it's safe. You know, I have been here in South Africa where the vaccine has started to be rolled out. And let me tell you, I have heard many versions of disinformation that the vaccine, you know, has a chip in it and that can cause irreparable harm to your DNA. I have heard it all. And so I think health authorities are concerned that when it comes time when the vaccine is available for regular people, there may be hesitancy.
And that's a problem for the countries that have the vaccine, Eder. But of course, I'm mindful that many do not yet. And we've seen countries like Kenya, Botswana, really struggle with a second wave of the pandemic. So for countries that are struggling in that way and don't yet have access to a vaccine, how are they responding?
I mean, everybody's sort of hoping for the vaccine, but there doesn't seem a real way forward. I mean, I think what is very clear is that many countries in sub-Saharan Africa are going to have to wait for the vaccine, not just this year, but maybe into next year. So they are lagging very far behind Western countries.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta in Cape Town, South Africa. Eder, thanks for speaking with us and take care.
Thank you.
Well, every day we have a slew of updates to share about COVID-19, the latest case numbers, new variants, testing, and the latest on vaccine distribution. But our next guest says one thing we're not getting right is our ability to see the forest for the trees and to understand truly what's working and what's not. Zeynep Tufekci is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and she's written a piece that lays out what she calls the five pandemic mistakes we keep repeating and what we can learn from our failures. Zeynep, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. So vaccinations have been happening in this country since December 14th. Millions of Americans have received it, but we still don't have updated guidelines on how to behave once we've been vaccinated. What's wrong with that picture?
I think what we need is guidelines that are tiered and targeted rather than one size fits all, because these vaccines are amazing. And the evidence is that it justifies especially private behavior guidelines, like what can two vaccinated people do together? Can they play a board game indoors if everybody's vaccinated in 2 weeks post their, you know, last booster shot? Also benchmarks for at what point will we also be able to have relaxed rules for public behavior, which is, you know, how what we do at the grocery store and elsewhere. Instead, what we have right now, if you go get vaccinated, you get a card that says keep masking, keep social distancing. And I don't think that's precise enough given what we already do know. I'm not saying we just throw all caution to the wind, because we still face a tough March. We face variants. There's a lot of things we need to be careful about, but we should adjust as we go along.
You know, one thing I was thinking about in regards to all of this is that is what you're saying also because the virus has shown the light of so many of our societal problems like racial and economic inequality. And that has led to a lot of finger pointing by politicians, which muddies up the messages that we receive and how it filters down to our everyday lives. You know, the response to the virus has been so politicized.
Absolutely. Politicization has made our response less effective and hampered what we could do. For example, we keep being told, stay home, stay home, stay home. But that's not exactly an accurate message for two reasons. One is that outdoors is great. There is not, as far as I can tell, after a year of tracking and studying, a single super spreader event that was solely outdoors. And the cases of transmission outdoors that we can trace are fairly few and involve, you know, talking at close range for a long amount of time. So instead of saying stay home, we should, on the one hand, say, please go out. And if you're going to socialize with your neighbors, because socialization is a deep human need, please do it outdoors. And on the other hand, there's a large number of people, millions of people, the most important in some ways victims of the pandemic, who cannot stay home because they're those frontline essential workers who are allowing us to stay home. So we might tell people avoid indoor dining, but that hides this fact that a study in California showed, for example, that line cooks are at the highest risk of death. So we're kind of blaming the victims almost as if the pandemic, right, if you get hit with COVID, it's your fault, when really it's much bigger things that not all of us have a say in.
Yeah. What you're talking about as well is about the dissemination of information. I'm just thinking about here in the state of California where I live, you know, we did not know until a media organization contacted the state to say, hey, are playgrounds for children at public parks open now? They've been closed since the beginning of the pandemic. No one had actually told the public that the parks had been opened up again. So you argue it's not just politicians and health officials who need to do some thinking. It's also the media as well.
Absolutely.
Can you explain more about that?
I think in the media, there has been a tendency to highlight terrible small things. You know, somebody throwing a tantrum in a grocery store because they refuse to wear a mask. I mean, it's terrible, but it's really rare. And also a lot of scolding of people for being parks and beaches. I've been tracking this for a year and it's constant. There was a vaccine adverse event, a single one. I believe it was a woman in Alaska. She had an allergy. She had it before. She had a reaction. It was treated immediately. And there was a notification sent by the New York Times to millions of people alerting them to the single incident, which didn't even have a terrible outcome.
Well, Zainab, I use the phrase when I introduce you that our ability to see the forest for the trees is kind of compromised because everything feels so chaotic. We're in the thick of it. Isn't that what happens during crises? I mean, in your article, you touch on what happened during the polio vaccine distribution. We can reflect and look back and see that clearly, but oftentimes when you're in the midst of a crisis, it's hard to see everything. What are some of your suggestions that, we should do to take a step back and actually kind of see what's laid out before us, the positives that have happened and what we need to work on?
So that's a great question. I think what we need right now is for the CDC and the administration to literally have daily briefings or town halls for the public saying, here's the top line. I want to know the basics. For example, you know, we're vaccinating and here's how great these vaccines are and why. Yes, there are variant threats, but here's why they're not a problem right now and here's what we're doing about it. In the meantime, you know, be especially careful in unventilated indoor spaces or poorly ventilated indoor spaces. Here's how you can upgrade your mask. And please enjoy the outdoors if the weather permits. It's the safest thing. You know, these little top level things, they're so important because these are not minor things. These are the quality of life and sort of keeping your health and well-being after a year. My world has been, like billions of people around the world, made much smaller. And it makes me more confident and strong in keeping up with what I need to do till then.
Zainab Tufekci is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you again for inviting me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it? And then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email.
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
The 10-year Treasury yield is coming off a rapid February surge that produced the highest rate in a year, 1.6% last week. It's dipping slightly on this first day of March, but some economists are concerned the elevated T-note could signal higher inflation on the horizon. The Treasury yield represents a rate at which the government borrows money. It serves as a benchmark for the economy, and gains can also mean the economy is doing better. For more, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
So the 10-year Treasury yield is starting off the week slightly lower after hitting that high last week. Help us understand what is going on in the bond market.
You know, first of all, I know bonds sort of make people's eyes glaze over. So stay with me for a second, gang. Basically,
okay, I'm with you.
Right. So what's happened is essentially two different things. One is that there is encouraging news about the economy, even though it kind of feels rotten right now, 10 million people out of work. A lot of data that have been released, like personal income and spending last week and some of the manufacturing data, are indicating that the economy is improving. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that when the economy starts to go a little bit more quickly, then the pace of inflation would follow and we would see bond yields start to rise. And remember, we're coming off of these extraordinarily low rates, 0%. But then there's this extra concern that maybe the Federal Reserve is going to keep rates too low for too long, and that in addition to accelerating growth, might create price increases or inflation. Put it all together, you have a little bit bond market freak out, a little stock market freak out, but today seems okay.
Okay, well, help us unpack the risk that you're hinting at there, because the 10-year yield is actually still well below historic averages, right? I mean, 4 or 5% was typical a couple of decades ago. It's been low for a while, in part because the Fed is keeping interest rates low during the pandemic. As the yield ticks back up, which can foreshadow inflation, some economists are worried, as you mentioned. So what is the risk?
You know, I think it's a little overblown. I mean, one economist said to me that, you know, everyone's getting spooked that interest rates are rising. But the fact that the Fed had to keep them at zero for the last year just shows how terrible the economy was. And so the idea that we start to see rates go up can be seen as a good thing. It's just the adjustment and how quickly this all happens and how the expectations start to shift that can throw people for a loop. Now, I will also say that, you know, frankly, with the economy improving and with another round of stimulus about to be teed up, it is likely we are going to see some price increases. We're not going to see runaway inflation. This is not going to be 1979 all over again. But in fact, inflation really had to start going back up to show that we are coming out of this horrible recession caused by the pandemic. So in some respects, I think it's a little bit of an overreach for people to go freaking out about inflation without really seeing where prices settle.
So real quick then, Jill, I mean, should we start thinking about mortgage rates and other personal finances going up?
I mean, I just have to laugh because, you know, when my very first mortgage, you're probably much younger than I am, but my first mortgage was 7.5%. And my father's like, oh, my God, that's so low. And now we're really worried that a 3 or 3.5% 30-year fixed rate mortgage is high. You know what? The idea that the mortgage market is going to settle a little higher from all-time lows is not surprising. And the fact that rates are going up also shouldn't be a surprise. Don't be fearful. It's all okay right now. We'll get through this.
Okay. Yeah, and talk to your parents and you'll feel better. That's
exactly.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thanks, Jill.
Take care.
For more than 28 years, the card game Magic the Gathering has offered a popular escape for the young and young at heart. Here's the premise. Players acting as powerful wizards called planeswalkers battle it out by drawing powerful spells and creatures to beat the opponent. And from the beginning, most of those planeswalkers have been white characters. Until now. Magic the Gathering is now exploring black life through a set of new cards called Black is Magic. Here's Sydney Adams, the lead designer of the set.
No matter who you are, you can celebrate black history. You don't have to be black to enjoy black stories. Black stories are human stories, and human stories deserve to be told. So we'll write them, and draw them, and speak them, and play with them, until everyone realizes that black is not a stereotype, a trauma, or a threat. Black is magic.
Black is Magic is a set of 7 cards illustrated by black artists, and each card has a message that aims to fight stereotypes. Lead designer Sydney Adams joins us now for more on this concept. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
What a powerful message behind Black is Magic. I know you were drawn to Magic the Gathering after seeing the character Kaya, the game's first black planeswalker, which was introduced in 2016. How did you go from there to being involved in Black is Magic?
I remember seeing the image of her just kind of leaning in the doorway. And I was like, oh, who's that? Because at that point, a lot of the games that I had been looking at didn't really have that many, black female characters that seemed, you know, confident or even were just sort of visible. So seeing her made me look into who she was. And then I found the game through her. At the time, I believe I was starting grad school. I had decided recently that I was going to be a game designer. And while I took a gap year, I was working with kids. My mother is a special education teacher. So sometimes I would work and basically do like community rehabilitation for kids since I grew up with that knowledge because of my mother. And during that time, I was playing a lot of games. I was doing a lot of play therapy with these kids. And I realized the impact that games had on them. And I kept having this like thought over and over when we'd be playing games. I'd be like, oh, I could do this better. Oh, I could do this. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. And then I just decided, all right, I'm going to do it. I got an internship with Wizards of the Coast. Mm. And that sort of started the journey.
Started the journey. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the designs on the cards. And we'll link the art on our website at hereandnow.org so our listeners can actually see it. But the first card we want to take a look at is titled Cultivate. It's two black children and they're watering a plant. But this isn't just any plant, is it?
No, no. This plant is the black lotus. The black lotus is the most expensive and valuable and rare card in Magic the Gathering. I also wanted the imagery and sort of the metaphor of the lotus, which is this flower that blooms from mud and becomes something beautiful and thrives in adverse conditions to be something that they themselves were able to cultivate and make grow.
And this second card, Teferi, is the game's first black planeswalker. It's a powerful wizard in the story who can bend time to his will. And in the art, he's smiling with his wife laughing next to him, his daughter climbing up on his back. Why do you choose this depiction for one of the most powerful figures in the game?
One thing that I really wanted to push home with this set was, you know, the humanization of black people, you know, and Teferi has been in the game for a very long time, and he has one of the most rich backstories in lore. You know, we saw him as a student, we see him as a young man, and then we see him as an adult and as a father. But often his fatherhood is something that takes a secondary lean when you think of him. But it is important to depict power and love together. I think especially for depictions of black men, it's important that we show that there can be softness, there can be love, there can be fatherhood. And this card is basically my love letter to black fatherhood and family. It shows that his power isn't just because he can stop time. It's because he has a support system and because he has love in his life.
Mm. There's so much dimension to these cards and the messages. What you're doing is showing the multitudes of complexity of black people. And it's not something that we often see. How long did it take you to really come up with these ideas and thoughts and deepen them in this way where you're being very intentional? As you said, this one in particular is a love letter to black men.
Yeah. This project has been in progress for over a year. The question that I had to constantly ask myself is, you know, what am I saying? And I think that the way that I found to be the most intentional was to make it as close as I could to home, you know? I made sure that I could relate in some way to every single story because ultimately I think it's important to show that black people are not a monolith and there are so many different versions of, you know, what we call blackness. I had a lot of research that went into each card. Part of the game is the fact that it's literally just a card. You can only convey so much information, and so every single word matters. And the way that it's affected the community has told us that we did the right thing.
You did the right thing. And you know, I know that your focus was on little black children so that they see themselves in this game. But how important is it for other players who aren't black to understand the importance of this and showing the diversity in black life through a game and through, as you said, a single card?
I wrote in my article that at the end of the day, I wanted people to see that product in the black community and to understand that, you know, we see you. And for anyone who's not part of that community who sees the project, something like fatherhood that Teferi is showing is a universal concept. And there are ways that you can relate to the product that aren't necessarily racial because black stories are human stories. But when you do see the race, I need you to understand that it is encouraging a group who needs to feel that support and needs to feel that inclusivity. And when you see it, you should be like, good. You know, you are one of us. You've always been one of us. We're going to fight for you to be here.
How do you keep that going? You know, I know Black is Magic will only be printed once. How do you actually ensure that this type of project isn't just a cash grab one-off during Black History Month?
I think one thing that's been helping is the fact that we also hired a DEI director. Chantel Layton is our new DEI director. And
just so our listeners know, can you explain what that is?
Oh, DEI. It's diversity, equity, and inclusion. She came in at the tail end of this project, and she, you know, helped us basically push it across the finish line. But she's also here to instill institutional and systematic change within our company. And I think this product specifically basically opened a dialogue. It opened a dialogue internally and externally in a way that is more direct than we have done in the past. Because this dialogue has now occurred, because we have spoken and had a stance on things that were potentially difficult, you know, Cultivate speaks on, you know, some of the discrimination that Black farmers deal with, the systematic oppression and prejudice that they face. Teferi is both honoring Black fatherhood, but also rejecting the stereotype that Black fathers are absent. So having done this, I've seen some fans are completely against it and they're like, oh, I'm done with the franchise. Mm. But the fans that are not, they're the ones who are going to continue to push us to make products that are worthy of their participation. And I feel like because this dialogue has happened, it's like Pandora's box, you know, like it's open.
It's open now.
Huh? So I feel like we just have to move forward. And I think we're going to.
Sydney Adams, lead designer of the Magic the Gathering set Black is Magic, 7 cards illustrated by Black artists, and we will have a viewing of them on hereandnow.org. Sydney, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the platform.
The pandemic has interrupted a lot of scientific field research, including a decades-long project at the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest in northern New Hampshire. Now scientists there are adapting with new technology and remotely recording the sounds of the forest. They hope it'll transform their long record of a changing world, a record that once helped inspire the Clean Air Act. Annie Ropeek of member station NHPR went to the forest to learn more.
Dartmouth College biologist Matt Ayers stands out in camo and cargo pants against the bright yellow of the woods in late fall. He's got binoculars around his neck, and he's loading gear from his truck into a backpack.
So we've got batteries, a drill, microphones, GPS.
Ayers' specialty is caterpillars, but today he's bringing me along on a bird monitoring mission in this 12-square-mile research forest on the southeast slopes of Mount Moosilauk. It's where scientists first discovered acid rain, which Ayers says has transformed environmental protection in America.
So when they started collecting those water samples and analyzing the chemistry, they didn't know that that would inspire the Clean Air Act, and they didn't know that those same samples now show that the Clean Air Act has been one of the best examples of environmental stewardship ever.
Over the years, research here has created a remarkably useful record of a single changing forest. But until recently, Ayers says, it's been missing one crucial feature of the landscape.
No one knows what it sounded like in the Hubbard Brook Forest, even 5 years ago. Sounds leave no fossils, no isotopic signatures. For the most part, they're here 1 millisecond and gone the next.
Sound can be a key measure of an ecosystem's health, revealing the behavior of, say, migratory songbirds and how they're reacting to changing weather patterns. Ayers shows me a strip of forest where scientists have surveyed those birds every summer for 51 years and recently began taking audio samples.
It's globally extraordinary data, but there will always be an asterisk on 2020.
The COVID-19 pandemic made it impossible for field biologists to live together at Hubbard Brook during survey season. So Ayers says they had to find new ways to fill in the gaps. They turned to their sound recorders and set them up in this part of the woods to run on their own.
Up this ridge, and off in both directions from us is a network of 30 passive acoustic recorders that all turn themselves on at the same time in the morning, record for 3 hours, turn themselves off, come back for another hour in the evening. And it's amazing. There's a symphony.
The success of remote recording last summer gave them the idea to do it again during mud season, when the roads and trails of the forest are all but impassable and the migratory birds are just starting to come back from the tropics to breed in New Hampshire. So today, Ayers is programming these recorders to turn on by themselves in the spring, weeks before a human can check on them. He guides me off the road and into the woods.
So it's this way, less than 100 meters.
Ayers follows his compass and GPS through the brush down a steep slope to the edge of the brook. Strapped to a tree is a metal equipment box. He opens it up and starts loading it with big new batteries, a fresh sound card, and a tiny microphone. This system and all the others like it in this valley will start recording at 5 a.m. on April 15th.
I've done things like this before, long-term monitoring, where I'm orienteering around to put sensors in, but they were temperature recorders, mainly. Nothing that produces the volumes of data that a sound recorder does.
Ayers says a major goal this year is to record the birds' spring return from the tropics for the first time. Spring is coming earlier in New Hampshire due to climate change, and how these migratory birds react is a case study for how that shift affects the whole ecosystem.
We've never been more interested in the timing of events than we are now, because that's one of the most dramatic and evident changes associated with climate warming.
Scientists can already learn a lot about that from their sound recordings, and with artificial intelligence, they're getting better at picking apart the songbird chorus, isolating the calls of species like the black-throated blue warbler, a focus of the annual survey. Ayers says there's no telling how these recordings might benefit future scientists, the same way they're still learning from the early acid rain samples that made Hubbard Brook famous.
It's inspiring to all the researchers that work on this, knowing that you're contributing to this data stream, which is going to have value that goes beyond what we can imagine now. Being able to go back and reanalyze those samples of bottled water from the Hubbard Brook and validate that the Clean Air Act worked. How powerful is that?
As the world works on other tools to address climate change, Ayers says Hubbard Brook hopes to continue to be useful in ways scientists may not have even considered yet. For Here and Now, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.